Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, Brad.
Yes.
Do you know how we fund the program Going Off Track?
I know exactly how we fund it. There's one source of income for us, and that is patreon.com/goingofftrack, where our loving patrons give us money and we give them bonuses.
Patreon? Stop making up words. It's a great place. We do a weekly Thursday night fireside chat. Brad takes all the embarrassing things I say in podcasts that he doesn't put into podcasts and puts it on the Patreon. Funny pictures of Brad in the 90s, usually naked or wearing a wristband. Please sign up. Brad, what's the address?
Patreon.com/goingofftrack.
My brother texted me the other day, you know, because my niece is a young burgeoning drummer, and he asked, Travis Barker or Taylor Hawkins? With no context, just that.
I'll take Taylor. And,
yeah, and I actually really started thinking about it. I'm like, okay, like, who do I actually like and appreciate more? And quickly, you know, like, my instinct is to go for Taylor because he's like my kind of drummer, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Like that dude, like he hits the way I hit. He plays, you know, he's obviously into fucking 70s rock and like,
right. You
know, does this cool stuff. But, you know, as far as the great scale of drummers and what they've accomplished, I mean, Travis Barker might be a more like vital and important kind of player, you know, because, he literally like, you know, Blink 182 does not sound like that, and they don't make the kind of jump they make without Travis Barker. I mean,
it's true. Yeah.
Their old drummer was great, but he's one of those guys, once you hit the really fast parts, you can hear that he's, you know, maybe catching up, maybe not. Like, and then all of a sudden, Travis Barker is just like an absolute machine. I mean, people forget.
Oh, he's a beast. He's
the
a beast.
Drums on those Vandals records, and then the stuff on the Blink, and then all the things he did with, you know, like Transplants, and now the crossover stuff he's doing with newer artists and a little more elect. Like, as much as I love Taylor, like, I do think Travis Barker might end up being like, you know, the more vital and important drummer. It's hard to tell.
Right. But Taylor's the guy that I want to jam with.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. If I'm just like stoned with a guitar, yeah. I don't want to jam with Travis Barker.
No.
I'd run out of the room. I'd be so annoyed. Yeah. No, I'd have
Taylor's,
to be on like, yeah.
Taylor's going to make anything that I do sound really good.
Right.
Like, without a doubt. And Travis, yeah. I can't keep up with him. I don't know where to start. So,
yeah, we've talked about this before. I do the types of drugs that put me into a Taylor Hawkins world. If I did different drugs, maybe Travis. I need to be a little more up. I've never been into the cocaine, you know? The kids still do cocaine, or do they have different ways to get themselves all worked up? Are they just all bumping Adderall and shit these days?
They're doing the coke.
They're still
doing
the coke?
It's cheap now. Yeah, it's cheap now.
How do you know?
Well, it was like, whatever, 10 years ago when I was still DJing. I didn't use it.
The evening, huh?
I didn't use it, but it seemed like every other fucking guy who was too old to be using it was. So,
yeah. Yeah. Did you ever have a coke nail?
No. I've done a lot of drugs, and coke was not really, you know, I think I was one of those guys that was up enough already that, like,
yeah.
I didn't need coke.
Yeah, I was the same. I was like, I was always like, yeah, I'm fine. I don't need to be worked up anymore. And then by the time like I was actually even somewhat interested, I was like, yeah, I'm too old to start doing coke.
Yeah.
Like if you're past like 27 and you do coke for the first time, that's an issue there. That's a whole nother set of problems.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Some weird early midlife crisis or something. Yeah. Like you don't want that. I think a cherry red convertible's in your future if you take that on. But anyway, speaking of midlife crisis, spoke
and
to
drummers.
and drummers. I mean, great drummers. Like, listen, Scotty is a very intimidating guy to be your drum tech because he's like better than you.
Oh, really?
He's one of those people where you like look over and you're like, oh yeah, like you could do all this, you know, you could do everything I'm doing. You're fine. So the greatest story I have about Scotty as a, you know, obviously we spent a lot of years on the road together. Good friends. I love him a lot. But something even took Scotty up a notch for me, which was, I think it was the first tour that he was being a drum tech for us. I don't even remember. It took me years to accept the fact that I like needed a drum tech. I denied it as long as I could. Like people were like, you should probably get one. I'm like, no. And then it got kind of strange after a while because I had this like ritual before the show where I had to go out, retighten my cymbal stands, give my snare a little once over, like just hit everything at least once, make sure it's cool before I jump up there. And it started to get kind of weird because I'd jump up there and people would be like, what's up, dude?
You're not supposed to do that. Yeah,
just fucking around in my shit for like 30 seconds and then I'm going to walk off again. And it kind of got weird. And then we started to kind of have like, you know, daytime offers for press and shit where like, I actually literally just couldn't be there anymore. So that's when I was like, you know, I had met Scotty through touring with Alkaline Trio and I knew he wasn't touring with them at the time. And we asked him to come out and like literally from the first day I was like, holy shit, this is awesome. 'Cause he was like so spot on. I mean, the heads were perfect after a couple days, like just tuned exactly the like, I've never just been able to like walk up behind a kit and just be like, all right, good to go. Like, I don't even have to check. Everything's perfect. And I know it's going to be. And one night we're playing and I look, you know, I hear something in the middle of the song and I'm like, oh, that sounds funky. And I look down and the snares on the bottom of my snare drum had popped off. So, you know, I didn't break a head, but I was basically like hitting a tom for my snare. Right. It sounded crazy, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's not good. You know, the song just started, so there's not much we can do. I'll get through like the 3 minutes of this song and then we'll swap it out. Not swap out the snares, like swap out the actual drum, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So this is my line of thinking there's no plan B. And then before I know it, I'm like, what the fuck? And I look down and there's Scotty under my legs, like during a show. I'm talking like a big show, lots of people. On my drum riser, under my legs, fucking taking a snare off. I was like, whoa. Like I didn't even know how he got in there. I kind of had the bail on my hi-hat foot, you know, which doesn't really matter for me. And I'm keeping the song going. And now I'm just like laughing. I'm like, wow, there's no way like he's going to pull this off. And literally before I know it, like maybe 45 seconds later, I'm still hitting. And all of a sudden the snare is back on. Scotty's done. He did it in like 90 seconds.
That's
he like
amazing.
Came under me and swapped out the entire snare. And I'm like, oh my God, this is an absolute legend. I'd hire him to work on my home. I'd hire him to work at my deli. You know, like it doesn't matter. Like this guy knows how to work and just knows how to get it done. You know, that was an incredible piece of drum teching that night. I'm still impressed, as you can see.
I'm impressed. It's like changing your oil while you're driving down the road, man.
And it's the absolute opposite of our co-host, Ian Perkins, who was a very good tech in his own way, but very, very messy. Very messy. He had these work cases that were just like filled with It was like if you took a junk drawer and just put it into a work box. Right. But he somehow knew where everything was, and kind of the exact opposite of the way Scotty is. But I thought it was interesting getting into, you know, the different styles of how people tour and how that kind of reflects their personality. You know, I've seen that over and over again when I tour. There's just kind of, it's almost like if you know somebody well enough, you kind of know exactly how they're going to tour before you even get out there, you know?
Nice. Yeah.
What was your vibe?
I used to explode on a hotel room, pretty much. Like, I just spread out, like, immediately and rapidly.
Okay.
But somehow, like, I had, like, my shit, like, in such a way, like, I used to, you know, I always had the right bag. And like I had like one of those bathroom toiletry kits so that I could fold it up just as fast. Like I could come and go very quickly. But I definitely like I would look around and kind of laugh because I was like, man, I really took over this room like instantly.
Just spread out.
Yeah.
But anyway, Scotty just, you know, I wanted to speak to him because he's got one of those really cool pass-through music. Sweep the Leg Johnny was a great band. He was, you know, in Chicago working at the Fireside Bowl and, you know, while the trio came up and all this like great music in Chicago in the 90s and then toured with all these great bands, toured with me. And now, you know, like accepted, you know, the stuff with Stadium Production where U2 shows up and says this really, really like broad understanding of touring and music and people. And he's really just one of the sweetest guys I know. So I wanted to have him on. And, thanks to the I-Man, Ian, John Perkins, for always being just, I don't know, pretty much the best person I know. And I think after this, Ian might need his own episode, huh?
It sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah, I think Ian's going to need his own episode. Please chime in and tell us if you'd like Ian Perkins to have his own episode. I got some questions for that guy. So yeah, I thought this was a blast, and thanks to Scotty and Ian for getting into it with us.
All right, let's check it out.
Let's listen. It's going on track.
Welcome, Scotty. Thank you so much for coming on. Ian, thank you so much for being the co-host with the co-most.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Majestic. I hope someone gets that. It's from the beginning of a Gangstar record. I even texted it to Ian, hoping so.
I thought it was Killers.
Different Majestic.
Was it Mr. No, that's
Mr. Brightside.
Oh yeah. Big hit. Big hit. It's a big hit.
I heard that's a good song. Scotty, yes. How are you?
I'm good. Waiting for this waiting for the world to go back to some kind of normal.
Yeah, that's right. So walk me through what life's been like for you a little bit the last year. How you been filling up your days and what have you generally been up to?
Well, we bought a house 5 years ago now, almost. It'll be 5 years in September. And it was a new house. So, it was nice and clean and easy to move into when things were real crazy. But, you know, I'm usually pretty busy and I haven't had a lot of time to do stuff. So this year I did, last summer I put in two patios in the backyard. I painted and insulated and paneled the garage.
Nice.
I painted the downstairs of the house. I painted my parents' house. I've just been like anything I can do to like keep the TV off.
Yeah. Right.
You know, because I won't let the TV go on until like after dinner.
Oh,
so
look at
so
that.
We just and Beck's been working. So, you know, I take care of the shopping once a week and cleaning the house and doing more cooking. And yeah, it's been, you know,
I love the TV not going on until dinner. That is
you're
a
missing
power
out.
Move.
You're missing yeah, out dude. All this daytime TV. I'm telling you.
Ian, you can't be awake for much of it, right?
Let me tell you about, I get up about 1-ish, 12 if it's early.
Have there's some goldfish.
There's all this stuff going on during the day on TV that you don't even know about.
Like, what are we talking? Like supermarket sweep still on, that kind of thing?
No, there's just a lot of people sitting around desks talking about stuff that went on in the morning that you got to catch up with. There's a lot of stuff going on. You can't be out there building patios and painting houses until you know what's going on.
It's pretty much always a law and order on.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff you got to catch up with from the morning that you've missed out on.
Scotty, are you the type like me where like if you even ingest the news in the morning, it just like kicks off like your day in the total wrong direction?
No, I kind of have to ingest news in the morning.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I've got that Apple News app. So I kind of get up in the morning and I usually get up a little bit earlier than Beck. And, I let the dog out and give him his breakfast, and then I usually kind of read the news in the morning like it was a newspaper.
All right.
Yeah. So
you need it.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, does it actually make you feel better about things to have this knowledge?
No, absolutely not.
Not even. Oh my God. So, Scotty, I'm watching some Sweep the Leg videos, and I noticed that you were I didn't realize you were a wristband wearer.
There's wristbands? I probably did have some wristbands.
Because Brad was a longtime wristband wearer in the 90s. Wouldn't play music without him. He had like special ones, and they're now sitting in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Where did you find these videos?
You were on something called YouTube. It's a website, and they post videos of different things. Now, they had a cool video from, I think, like, 06 when there was that little run of shows, or maybe even just one show, that Sweep played. Did you play that show? I couldn't tell. The guitar player was doing some crazy antics where the drummer was hidden.
2006. We were done by then.
Yeah. I wonder what that was. Yeah. But anyway.
Huh. Tribute band.
So I wanted to get back, Scotty. Like, you know, you have a long, rich history that obviously some of the listeners of this program don't know about. And I mean, I'm curious because, like, you know, we toured together so long and we've known each other a long time, but, you know, you sort of sometimes miss years and miss elements of people's lives when you just come in too late, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
So I kind of forget, like, you know, what was the background? What was the Anna household? Like, what was the situation that kind of to led you, you know, going down the path of, you know, drums and music? Like, what was going on when you were a kid there?
When I was a kid, so mom put us in piano lessons. I was 7 when I started piano lessons, I guess. Okay. I did that for a couple years, and I didn't, you know, I should have done it more.
Right.
And tried to enjoy it, but I didn't. And then in fourth grade, so 9 years old, the orchestra comes to the class and shows some instruments. And I went home and I told my mom I wanted to play the cello.
Okay.
Cello. Well, the cello is very expensive.
Yes.
And the cello is probably pretty excruciating to parents' ears. Oh, yeah. With a beginner playing. So they said, why don't you wait for a year and see what band has to offer?
Okay.
So I waited for a year, and then, I told them I wanted to play the drums. So I got a little a practice pad and
How close to being a cellist you were.
So close to being a cellist. My principal gave me his snare drum from when he was growing up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Mr. Cool.
Stop it. The guy who gave you your first drum was named Mr. Cool.
Mr. Cool.
That's awful. <Yeah. laughs>
Wouldn't that be great?
I was like, oh man, this story.
Straight from Mr.
This
Cool.
Story already. Like, goodness.
You can call me Mr. Cool.
So he gave you a snare, and then what were you? Did you do like a lot of like marching band or
anything
like that?
I did all that shit. I did concert band, you know. Through junior high and high school. And then in high school, you wanted to play in the jazz band if you're a big, you know, nerd like
right,
I was.
Right,
and
yeah.
In order to do that, you had to do the pep band and you had to do the marching band. And then I was in the orchestra.
Okay.
Yeah, the whole thing.
So you're a full on. So you wore those, you know, those like military style, like marching uniforms that those kids wear?
So ours were, we had the drummers at different ones. Ours were really bad. So the school colors were like red, white, and blue, obviously, like of most high schools, I think. Yeah. And so
Ian,
the,
just so you know, those are the colors of the U.S. flag.
Yeah. Not just the Union.
I've never seen those colors before.
But yeah, we had a nice kind of Australian style cowboy hat with, you know, flipped up on one side.
Really?
It was black, hard, like it was like hard plastic, but then like kind of covered in velvet.
Oh, goodness.
And then this puffy shirt. Like, it was horrible. But then you could just wear black jeans. Which, you know,
who signed off on this? Mr. Cool did not sign off on that.
Mr. Cool.
Ensuring you could only date people in the band with you.
There's none of that going on.
That's awesome. So when you were in like high school, when did, you know, kind of like the alternative culture, you know, catch your attention? When did you start getting into alternative music and interest in like playing drums and bands and stuff?
Yeah, that would have been like halfway through, because I went in to high school and through junior high like full on, you know, Motley Crue, Def Leppard, AC/DC, yeah, which I still love all that
sure
stuff, obviously.
All great.
But
all great.
I mean, Van Halen was like my thing. But yeah, it was probably 16 or so when you started getting more into, you know, skateboarding and, you know, more I didn't get real into punk rock right away. I was more into the new wave scene, like a lot of New Order and Depeche Mode and all that.
Right,
kind of
right.
And then the college rock REM.
And what led you, you know, down that road? Did you have like influences in the house or just like friends from school? Like,
yeah, just friends from school, really.
And when did you form your first band? When did that start?
I was in my first year of college, I only went to college for about a year and a half.
And that was in Chicago?
No, I was in Central Illinois.
Okay.
Yeah. And there was a band down there that the drummer had quit or something like that. So I started playing with them and played with them for about a year. And we just did like, you know, stuff around the Midwest and stuff on campus. And we had a van, so we got out a little bit, but not much farther than like Iowa and Ohio.
What was that band called?
It was called Catherine's Horse.
That's a pretty good name. That's so perfectly
so there's
Midwest,
this like
early 90s. That's so awesome.
So there's this like, yeah, the story was that Catherine the Great, you know, no man could satisfy her, so yeah.
Interesting. Oh, that's right. She was a horse fucker.
Wait.
Whoa.
Yeah, whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Whoa. Listen.
It's history, dude. It's not me. It's history.
Wait. Let's go back here. Which Catherine are we talking about?
Catherine the Great.
Oh, this is noted? She had sex with animals?
No, this is what I was told when I joined the band, when I asked why is the band called Catherine's Horse.
I was like, shit, I should have paid more attention. History was interesting.
It is. It's very interesting.
That's awesome. So so you did that little stint in college, and what was your impetus for like getting down to Chicago?
I decided to go to Columbia. And took some classes there for a semester, I guess.
Okay.
And so that left that band, and then just, you know, we started bands with friends that I grew up with and friends from like the Chicago area.
Now, like what kind of kid were you? Were you, you know, pretty mellow, got along with everyone, or at the same time you started getting into this music, were you really like kind of defining your individualism and trying to, you know, see yourself out of that town and stuff a little?
I definitely was more of a get along with everybody type kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. And still am. Yeah. You know, it doesn't really matter what you're into. As long as you're not a dick, you know.
Right. As long as no one's making fun of New Order, you are fine.
Exactly. What were you studying at university?
This and that. I literally just bounced from, I started with like some just general education courses, and then I took some like education classes, like to become a teacher. Both my folks were teachers, and I kind of thought that was the only thing I could do.
Yeah. What did they say though when you dropped, when you're like, I want to be in Catherine's horse and not be a teacher?
I actually called my dad and told him that I didn't want to stay in school anymore. And I called him in time for him to still get all his money back, because I was fortunate enough to have parents that were willing to pay for my college. So I just saved him a bunch of money, I guess.
So like, listen, Dad, no more education, but I got out before the next bill.
Yeah.
You can buy a boat. Cool. Get out of there. Yeah,
okay. Get out.
Yeah.
One last thing. Go deliver something on a bike, pal. So when you made it down to Chicago, what was like the, you know, how did you start making your way and getting into the scene there? What year was that too, by the way?
So that would have been like 92.
Okay.
Yeah. Somewhere around 92, 93. Brian Peterson, who booked the Fireside Bowl.
Right.
That it wasn't started yet, but he and I grew up together. He was a couple years older than me, but we've known each other since I think I was probably like 9. And he was 11.
And just for the people listening, can you tell them where you grew up?
I grew up in Elgin, Illinois, which is about 35 miles outside of downtown Chicago.
It's close to where Wayne Campbell's from, right? Is it close to Aurora? Idea.
It is close to Aurora.
Yeah, okay. I thought Wayne and Garth were your names.
Yeah, my mom. Oh, yeah. My mom grew up in Aurora, actually.
Okay, cool. So you reconnected with Brian Peterson down in Chicago?
Yeah, and I was just kind of working odd jobs and playing in just random, you know, little bands. And when he started doing the Fireside, I was bartending at a couple places. And so I started kind of helping out there with, you know, just pouring drinks and
yeah,
drinking at the other half.
Where was your head at in those days? Like, you know, you were sort of moving away from school, just playing in bands, yeah, working at bars. Like what was the plan or was it the no plan?
There was zero plan. It was buried. It was buried in that bottle. We had a good time right. all the time.
Yeah.
And you know, we were starting to, you know, the idea was to get a band so you could go out and tour.
Yeah.
Right. Like tour more than just, you know, Midwest.
And, I mean, what was going on in like Chicago in in those years was, starting to kick up a lot of interesting bands. Like what was the scene like in the early 90s? Pretty
it was thriving. Hopping.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mid 90s, especially, but right. I mean, at Fireside, we were having shows, you know, sometimes 6 nights a week.
Yeah, that's crazy. And, was it all Brian? Brian was booking all of those, or were there a number of people?
No, there was another guy named Dave Eves at the beginning.
Uh-huh.
The two of them kind of tag teamed it, and then Dave moved on, and then, you know, a couple other people came in, and Brian was always, you know, there, but a couple other people he always had his helping out a little bit.
So did you kind of get connected in the scene and have these jobs like before you got in Sweep the Leg Johnny? Like, was that sort of your connection to those guys in that band?
Yeah, I actually, Steve and I, who played sax and sang in Sweep, he and I went to summer camp together.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. And they went to Notre Dame. So we had always stayed in touch. And I used to go to Notre Dame just to kind of, you know, visit for the weekend. And, they were in a couple different bands then. And then when they moved to Chicago, after they graduated, cause they actually graduated from college, the bass player and drummer left, and there was a guy named Matt Alisea and Matt was like this, there's a band from back in this time called Tommy Rot. That was just like, if you can find any Tommy Rot stuff, it's just amazing. The first drummer of Alkaline Trio was actually the drummer of Tommy Rot, but,
oh, okay.
So Matt and I were in a band, and that band wasn't really doing much. And so we joined Sweep.
And what was, like, you know, Sweep now, especially in retrospect, I know, like, during that time, there was some bands around that were kind of kicking around some of these ideas a little, you know, maybe like your Cap and Jazzes or something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, what was the actual, like, mentality going into Sweep and starting that band? Because the music is just so unique, and it still sits in a very unique place that I wonder, like, really, like, what were you guys listening to, and what was the, you know, the intention of it when you started?
I think the funny thing was that we all really listened to different things. There was definitely like an overlap, you know, but I liked a little bit heavier and faster stuff. And, you know, everybody kind of had their own thing. And then to incorporate the saxophone into it, and everything, yeah, you know, which he played kind of more like a guitar.
Right. Yeah,
it was just, and then when we wrote songs, we all wrote together in the space, and I don't know, sometimes we just couldn't end songs, so they just turned out to be 13 minutes long.
There was like no rules to it. You didn't have any interest in keeping it like pop oriented at all, right?
Definitely not. No.
Yeah. And there were other bands. There were other bands there that just, it wasn't like you were just the only ones doing it. There were other bands, like growing up in England, I always looked over and like saw like Chicago was this or LA was that, DC was this.
Right.
But was Chicago, there were other bands doing that that you just fit in with?
Yeah, there's like the whole kind of math rock experimental, you know.
Who were the
like,
bands? Who were the Chicago bands? Tell us.
I mean, the biggest one that people would probably know of would be Shellac.
Ah, you know, right.
Steve Albini's band.
Yeah.
But like you mentioned, Benny the Cat and Jazz, there's a band called Psychic Kato. You know, there's a handful of them, but we didn't really play with bands that sounded like us. Firestar was like, you'd play with like the lineups would just be very, diverse. So right. we used to play with Alkaline Trio like all the time. It wasn't a second thought because we were just buds. So it's just, it didn't matter what. Like everybody was kind of into everything and very accepting.
Right.
Yeah. Fireside always had just had to, even though it was crazy and disgusting at times, it just had a really good, like, I hate to use the word vibe. I really do, but it did. It had a
use
good
it,
vibe. To
use it.
It.
Yeah. I mean, I can even confer. I have a little side story about Fireside. Like, you know,
yeah, you've been there, right?
Only once, and in a very strange context. I was touring with my band, The Low End Theory, in probably 98 or something. And it was the old bass player from Poison the Well had booked our tour. We were at the Fireside Bowl, and we took a very long, I forget where we were coming from, but it was many, you know, like a 10-hour drive or something to the Fireside. We show up, of course, we're stoked. We're like, wow, the Fireside Bowl, this is great. And they go, we don't know who you are.
Oh no.
And we're like, wait, what? Like, look right here. You're on the schedule. You're on the tour manifest, you know? And like, they're like, yeah, we've never heard of you. And so the person who had booked the tour just threw it on the schedule there without actually booking the show. So, you know, our bass player calls on the payphone and jaws out this booking guy. I wouldn't even call him a booking agent. You know, he's just a dude. And, we're like, oh, fuck, like, what happens now? We just literally pissed away, like, you know, $200 in gas getting here. Like, I don't even know. And, you know, speaking of vibe, they were like, there's a show tonight. You guys can play. Like, get the fuck out of here. And it turned out, I'm sure you know the band, Scotty. It was a band called Lynyrd's Innards.
Oh, yeah.
Which was like a pretty well-known Chicago punk band, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so it was ended up being a Lynyrd's Innards shows. They not only let us play, they gave us some beer, gave us some money off the door, you know, whole thing. Like, it started as like the worst day and ended up a very, very fine day. So
you gotta love that.
Yeah, so I do really, I mean, you know, there's not a lot of places you'd walk into that would do that. So the idea that there was some pretty awesome vibe at that place makes sense, you know?
Yeah. We actually got lucky like that with Jawbox in Florida one time.
Oh, really?
I was a huge Jawbox fan, and we had called the promoter. It was in Pensacola, and we had called the promoter just to check on everything. He's like, "I got good news and bad news. Good news is the show's all confirmed and everything." And you know, this is like 2 days before the show, and you're still making sure it's confirmed. Yeah, but he's like, "Bad news is Jawbox is playing like two blocks away."
Oh.
He's like, but I'm going to try and get you on the bill.
Oh, shit.
So I was like, all right. We end up going to this kid's house, like the day before the show, his parents' house. His mom makes us dinner. We're going to crash on the floor. And the phone rings in the house because it's way before cell phones. And it's Kim Coletta from Jawbox.
Oh, shit.
Asking to speak to me. And she says, so you guys want to play on the show with us? And we're like, yeah, it'd be amazing. And so they let us play. They gave us $100 out of their pocket. Wow. And they gave us all their green room beer because they had enough in their van already.
Look at that.
Sweet or cool.
Oh, man. I'm going to spin a Jawbox record extra tonight.
They're so good.
And you know, Zach, I'm sure you know Zach Barak is the drummer.
Yeah.
Who I'm sure we both have stolen many things from.
Nice.
He randomly... started working at a bookstore in Jersey City, and I slightly recognized him, but like didn't put it together. One night I had a bit of a situation at the restaurant next door, and I had to rush into the bookstore and blow up their bathroom.
Oh, a situation.
Oh, yeah.
A situation.
And it was one of those times I walked in. I was kind of like, maybe it was just my body language or something, but Zach looks at me and he kind of just gives me like closes his eyes very softly and gives me the nod. You know, he's like, oh, I see what's happening here. Go ahead. You know, and I'm even sitting there in the bathroom like, you know what? That dude was cool. Like nice, you know, like he got it. He got it. Good for him. And then I put it together like a couple weeks later. I'm like, holy shit, you're the drummer from Jawbox. It also makes sense why an old touring person was empathetic towards
exactly.
A situation. Right?
He's been there, I'm sure.
Sure, he's been there.
Oh, man.
We've all been there.
Yeah, I've been there a lot. So when you were in the middle of this, Scotty, like, you know, when this was all going on in those years with, because this is right, like early Trio. Slapstick, like early Lawrence Arms, like all these great bands coming out of Chicago, this great venue that people from all over the country are getting to. I know there was like a thriving underground scene and houses and stuff. Did you realize at the time it was special or only really in hindsight?
Yeah, I think we did because the bands that were, the bands were moving on, you know, and getting bigger. Like, you know, Jimmy World, for example.
Right.
You know, remember seeing them there a couple of times, and then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, they're huge, and just the way that it ran itself, and you know, we were touring at the time, so we'd see other venues around the country, and we definitely knew it was a special spot. Yeah, for sure.
That's awesome. What was the band that would play in those days that you wouldn't miss?
That I wouldn't miss.
Yeah, like if they were playing anywhere in Chicago, you were there.
I thought you meant the band. Oh, no. I got it completely wrong. I was the opposite way. I was like, wow. Who's the band that just
you
fucking
would never
suck.
Go fucking yeah. see if your life depended on it. All right, well, let's give this
away
question.
Free beer. Yeah. Nope,
I was
not
like,
going.
Wow.
Yeah, well, you'll be both.
If it was just like a show in Chicago, but not a Chicago band, it was definitely Rocket from the Crypt.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Like Rocket from the Crypt in Chicago was just, it was an event.
And what about Ian's question? The band you would never go see.
I'm not going to answer that.
Yeah.
Don't answer.
Here's back to the diplomatic nice guy again.
There you go. See?
Have you seen any resurgence in Sweep the Leg Johnny activity since Cobra Kai came out?
No. We don't even have a social media account.
So no.
But we are re-releasing an album.
Which record are you putting out?
It was the third release, Sol Staccato.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And now
so
we'll be able to find you digitally and things after this.
Yeah. That's the main reason we're doing it. So it'll be on iTunes and Spotify and we're going to re-release the vinyl.
That's awesome. Have you all talked about maybe doing a show or anything?
No. We're kind of all over the world right now. John, the bass player, is in Tijuana.
Oh, wow.
Steve is in China.
Whoa.
And Chris and I are here in Chicago still.
So I would imagine that at least one member from every math rock band has to live in Asia eventually.
Right.
That's part of the criteria.
He's been there, right? he's been there for a while now.
So you're working at Fireside in those years. Can you remember a night, a couple nights, a particular instance that was just like, whoa, what is going on here? Like, what's the craziest night at Fireside Bowl in those years? The wackiest thing that happened?
I mean, there was always dumb fights.
Right.
But we were very self-policed. Like, people kind of looked out for the place because it was so not legit that, like, if the cops came there too often, you know, it definitely would have right, ended. Right, except right. There were a couple guys that patrolled the neighborhood that were they were huge Pegboy fans, and they were into a decent amount of punk rock. So they'd come in uniform.
Wow.
Every now and then, and like, we got to know them, you know, but the kids would still freak out.
A couple cop Pegboy fans. I love that.
The cops are going to shut it down. Yeah. But there was some car robberies that were happening and vans getting broken into and things like that and gear getting stolen. And the cops that were Pegboy fans actually were the ones that kind of set up a whole little operation and caught the people doing it. So.
Oh, really? What was that?
Yeah.
They like actually did like a sting?
Yeah, they did. Like, they like got up on the roof and watched the street for a while until like someone.
Really?
Yeah,
that really happens in real life with it like really a box happens. Of donuts and just binoculars.
Only in Chicago.
Yeah, wow. I'm just imagining two Chicago cops up on a roof,
hot dogs.
Listening to Field of Darkness, and just like noshing out. Like, I guess they have a pizza, you know. Like in my
couple hot dogs.
Oh, like dogs, right? Cops probably eat dogs in Chicago, right?
Definitely. They can eat what they want. They're on the roof doing the good work.
Doing his thing. So they actually did they set up like a dummy van?
I don't recall, to be honest with you, but they did set up something where they caught the guys that were doing it.
Wow.
So
that's pretty awesome that you had that.
That neighborhood was rough and tumble in those years.
It's not anymore. Is it part of the areas that got gentrified and stuff?
It's kind of on that border. It's a bit north of like Logan Square, you know, Wicker Park, but it's just kind of in its own zone.
Right.
So it's not fully gentrified in like Wicker Park and Logan Square still got its areas, but back then it was thick.
I heard about a legendary bartender you used to work with, Hammer or Hamir.
Yeah, Hamir.
What was that guy's vibe?
He's he was a gambling addict.
Oh,
he was when I started working there. He didn't work there. He was just like the neighborhood guy.
Oh, okay.
Like he just, but he was a raging alcoholic.
Okay.
Like raging to the point where he would come into the Fireside. And he would have me make him a drink, which was essentially like, so in a Long Island iced tea, for example, you have vodka, gin, rum, tequila, triple sec, and then you throw in some like sweet and sour and Coke.
Right.
So he would essentially put like vodka, gin, rum, tequila, and Jägermeister into like, you know, like a 12-ounce solo cup.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, no ice, about 75-80% full.
Oy.
And then splash a Coke.
Just a dab.
And just drink it like it was a glass of water. Oh, and then go in the ice room where he had a hidden bottle of Southern Comfort that he just pounded on.
Okay.
So then his doctor told me he was going to die if he kept drinking. So he stopped. And then he started working there. Oh, and he still works there.
No shit. Really?
He still works there. Yeah.
Wow. So he was just like a neighborhood dude who used to get bombed there, and then everyone became friends with him. He started working there.
Yeah. He used to get bombed at every neighborhood on the corner or every corner neighborhood.
Did you ever rename his drink? Like, instead of a Long Island, was it like a Gary Indiana iced tea?
No, Gary Indiana.
Something like that.
Oh my God. Yeah. The owner of Fireside, his name is Jim, and his dad owned it before him. And so kind of grew up going to the neighborhood and just knew Hammer from,
he was just a neighborhood guy. When did it actually convert from like a bowling alley?
I think shows started, it was like 94.
Oh, okay. So it was actually like a functioning bowling alley, like right until then.
Yeah. I think it was a failing bowling alley.
Right.
Yeah.
How's your game? Can you bowl? I bet you can bowl.
It's definitely. Right.
You're good. You are good. I know it.
I haven't gone in a long time. I went a couple of times when we were living in England. And it's expensive to bowl in England, man.
Right.
Everything's expensive in England.
Well, don't they have those little pins over there?
They're little pins.
It's funny bowling, isn't it? It's not real bowling.
No,
they got real bowling.
Oh, you have real bowling?
Yeah. Huh. We invented it, didn't we?
Yeah, I mean, you've invented like all the sports that we poached, essentially. Except for lacrosse. I think that one's ours. Got it. But, all right, so speaking of which, the fact that everyone from the Midwest can bowl and probably has their own custom ball, I stumbled upon an article, okay, getting into this interview. This is Business Insider magazine, ironically, from June 18, and the title is Common Misconceptions About the Midwest, 8 Things That Coasties Get Wrong. I'd never heard myself called a coastie before.
Coastie?
Yeah.
Coastie?
You'd never heard this either?
No.
Oh, I thought it was like a ham and cheese coastie, you know? Like. all right. So here are the 8 things, okay? Some of them are ridiculous. But this is straight from Business Insider magazine, a periodical of note. All right. First, everyone is polite. Let's do true or false for the common misconceptions about the Midwest. Everyone is polite.
False.
Not everyone, but a lot. But based on your experience, is there a higher percentage of politeness than, say, New Jersey?
In Minnesota, especially.
Oh, they're the nicest in the Midwest?
Oh, definitely.
Oh, I didn't know that. That makes sense, actually. All right. No diversity. I didn't like this one. That makes no sense. We're going to skip that one because there is that. It just depends where you go, right?
Of course.
This one was weird. It said, it's okay to make fun of them. An example being, in quotes, campy wedding cakes, bait shop gunfights, and ranch dressing themed gender reveal parties.
Sure.
I don't even understand that. What?
What are you talking about?
Ranch dressing themed gender reveal parties? I'm not.
Wow.
I actually, now that I read that back, I don't think you should use ranch dressing while doing a gender reveal. That's dirty.
Yeah. Messy.
Okay. Yeah, messy. Don't like it. Okay. Everyone is a farmer.
False.
No one is cultured.
False.
Whoa. False. I know. It's a terrible article.
Who wrote this?
Hunting and fishing are the main pastimes.
False.
But close.
Depends on your circle.
Sure. All right. Corn,
they definitely exist.
Corn is everywhere.
True.
The band or the food?
Both, probably.
No.
I bet there's parts of Illinois that have a big like corn ICP kind of population. I'd imagine.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, once you get out west there. All right. And it's a flyover region. I'd never even heard that before.
False.
So let's just go ahead and say, fuck this Business Insider magazine article. It was just baiting us into some strange argument.
We've got like the second busiest airport in the country.
Yeah, I didn't like this.
Can't fly over.
Yeah, Brad, we might cut this. No. So But all that being said, what are some observations on coasties that you've had through the years? You've toured with plenty. Are we mean? Are we that much different than people from the Midwest?
I don't think so. I know you have a fascination with people from the Midwest.
I do. Yeah.
Yeah.
I am. But yeah.
I don't think you're any different.
Do you mean fascination by I like the movie Fargo?
No, I just know you. I do know that. But I know that you enjoy the Midwest, like our simpleness. Our niceties.
Yeah, I don't think it's simpleness, because unlike this Business Insider article, I am not like a bigot towards people from the Midwest. Is this
no, no, I didn't. Yeah,
I've met, you know, some very rich, cultured, educated, interesting, creative, like everything you get anywhere else in the Midwest. I think the thing that's different is just this general difference in how you treat people, a general difference in how you communicate, like where someone from where Ian's from or someone where I'm from, when you start to like someone, you make fun of them more. You know, like you just break their balls, like you get inside, you got to like take them down a peg in some weird way.
And yeah, I think Chicago's got that same thing.
Yeah, maybe the city. But I feel like, you know, the general person in the Midwest, it's just this like kind of less combative way to be, you know, like a little more open, a little less rushed, a little less intense. And I do find it like soothing to be around. And I love the accent. When you said roof before, I was giddy with excitement because I love the way it sounds. Say it again.
Roof.
Roof. Roof.
Gotta get on the roof.
That's great. But I am semi-obsessed. But I want to talk about something I know you love. Yeah, I know you're a big movie fan, especially from certain eras. I want to go ahead and let's rank the top five Chicago movies in history.
Oh, man.
All right. So I have a bunch written out here, but these are the ones that I need on my top five. And you tell me if I'm wrong. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Are they based in Chicago or filmed in Chicago?
Based. And I'm also going to include Chicago adjacent, like Home Alone or something like that.
Okay? Suburbs.
Yeah. So I got this on my list, and you tell me what I'm missing. I got Ferris Bueller's Day Off,
mm-hmm.
The Fugitive.
Yep.
High Fidelity.
Yep.
Home Alone.
Yep.
And for me, this number five slot is somewhere between Adventures in Babysitting and Untouchables.
One. Yeah.
Ooh.
See, I'd pull High Fidelity off personally.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that because the actual story itself is English?
And they I just wasn't a fan of it.
Really?
Yeah. I should probably watch it again.
Too whiny?
I love Cusack normally too. I don't know. Maybe I watched it at a bad time.
It
was filmed right down the street from where we were living at the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was filmed on Milwaukee Avenue, like down the street from where Reckless Records is now. But like right on the Milwaukee and Wood.
Okay.
Did they take your parking or what? But tell us the real reason. There's a reason.
That's why
they stole your spot.
Closing the street.
All right. So but, if we're taking High Fidelity off, what are we putting on?
Can we go a little campy and do Red Heat?
Oh, good one.
Good. And I'd like to bring up. Listen, we're still missing. Out of this list, I haven't brought up Backdraft, Running Scared, Road to Perdition, The Blues Brothers,
and also
Rookie of the Year. I mean, that's like the only Cubs movie there is, you know?
Uncle Buck.
Oh,
we even got Uncle Eight Buck. Men Out.
I mean, you can pretty much just go John Hughes and
yeah, the John Hughes top
take
five.
Take your pick.
You can't lose The Untouchables, though. You can't lose that one, dude.
Yeah, Untouchables is great.
That's a classic film.
Well, you could lose Home Alone. I'd swap Home Alone for Uncle Buck.
So we got Fugitive, Ferris Bueller's, Uncle Buck, No Home Alone, No High Fidelity, Untouchables, and what?
Adventure. While You Were Sleeping.
Yeah, While You Were Sleeping. That is a good one. It's crazy. This is a lot of movies. There's like, besides for LA and New York, Chicago's got to take the cake for this many films.
Now we got all the, just all the TV shows that are on.
Oh, well, like Chicago Fire, Med, and Cops.
PD. Yeah.
My mother-in-law likes those programs.
Oh, does she?
She
does. I've never watched any.
I try not to watch them. Well, that's good. Anything we're missing here?
Films? No.
No, we got them all.
Those were the ones, would have been the ones I rattled off.
Cool.
So The Dark Knights are great, but that's not.
Oh, yeah. You know,
but that's not Chicago.
Yeah.
But were they filmed there?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
It makes more sense. Yeah, I guess that's why Hines Ward was in it.
It's all Laura Wacker.
Huh. That's crazy. I didn't know that. Now, you were telling me something before that was super interesting. So, you know, we're going to jump a little bit. Obviously, you're not in Sweep the Leg Johnny anymore. And obviously, you do not work the Fireside Bowl anymore. and there were a lot of years in between that you, you know, hit the road, like, seriously. And so what was that transition for you from, like, playing and really trying to do your own bands? And how did it transition to you from, you know, getting out on the road and just, like, making your way a different way?
Yeah, so we toured a lot for about 5 years. Like, we were on tour constantly, but we weren't making any money.
Right.
We were going to Europe quite often, and in the van around the States constantly, but we all had to work like 3 jobs when we got home so we could pay our rent.
Right.
So we could go back out on the road. Yeah, and that was getting old. The Fireside was kind of under this umbrella of going away, because the park was expanding. That's down the street from there. So kind of started getting other jobs and wasn't really into it and wasn't touring with Sweep anymore. And, the first band that I worked for after that period, after Sweep broke up, was Trio.
Right.
Yeah. Cause they had been making money and having a crew for a while at that point, for quite a few years.
What year was that?
It would have been like 2007.
Oh, okay. So yeah, they were pretty established by them.
Yeah.
So that's when you jumped on with them, and it was just like, hey, like, Scotty's around. We know him from back in the day. Let's take him on the road. Or
yeah, we had all kind of spent time living together. Matt was living out in California already. So when he came back, he had an apartment that was above mine at the time. And I lived with our buddy Dave. And then my brother was living up there for a little bit. And then when Derek joined the band, they were still practicing in Chicago because Danny still lived in Chicago. Mm. And Derek slept on my couch for a while. And
nice.
So we were super tight. And so Keith, who was the drum tech before me, had moved on, and so I kind of hit them up and you know, asked if I could jump in.
What was the first run you did with them?
It was a headlining run on the West Coast. I remember we started. I can't remember. Started in like San Francisco.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was like being around Trio like early on and stuff, was it one of those bands that when they like formed and got established and playing around that it was sort of an automatic, like, you know, something special going on here? Or did it take a little while for them to get their footing and people to realize, like, what was the beginning of Trio like?
They got off to a pretty good start.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they had it was a different lineup at first. It was obviously Matt, and then a different bass player and different drummer.
Right.
And then Danny joined for the first full length, and Glenn was still drumming for two full lengths.
Okay.
And then, you know, they kind of, Asian Man picked him up because Danny was in Slapstick with my brother.
Yes.
And so they were already on Asian Man. So I think they had a good jump start, and their songs, I mean, their songs are so catchy.
Yeah.
So hooky. And they were such a fun band live when they were super young too. Cause it was just debauchery on stage.
Yeah. And Skiba was like, he was like 18 when they started. Right. Or like very young.
Yeah, he was young. He was definitely over 21 when Trio started. When I met him, he was 18.
Okay.
He was in a band called Jerkwater.
Was it Jerkwater?
Yeah.
Nice.
He played drums.
Ian and I were talking before on text a little about how, you know, Skiba's like, to us, one of the last true like rock stars. You know, like, to me, like, he's one of those people who walks into a room and just has this like, you just kind of notice him. He has that like presence. He's like one of those people. Did you pick up on that, and or did you just know him too well? And like, did you see people kind of react like really strangely around him eventually?
I don't think people ever acted strangely around him, because he never acted strangely around other people.
Yeah, that's true.
I think, but he definitely, like, the charisma you're talking about is 100% there, and it always was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he's even when you met him when he was young, you're just like, oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This dude's
yeah.
got something going on there.
I got him his first fake ID.
Really? Where was that?
It was my buddy Alan, who was my age, so a couple years older.
Yeah.
They just could pass for one another, so Alan just got a duplicate.
That's awesome.
Good job we haven't set a sting operation up on this call.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
Got to get those Pegboy guys back.
Yeah. Sitting on the roof right now.
So this is a good time to bring up a little segment on The Friend called Mystery Friend. So I went ahead and spoke to one of your very old friends and got an old story. So I'd like you to tell me a little bit about this story, what the context was, and then you have to guess which friend told me, okay?
Oh, you really did research.
Oh, yeah. Scotty, I love you. You know?
I love it all
the way. So I heard when you were a young man, about 17 or so, you were doing acid. Had a guy named Jed Babbitt's house.
Right.
Had a couple girls over. It was extremely awkward. And the older brothers came home and played you Smashing Pumpkins and vibed out your acid trip super good. Do you remember this?
Well, I wasn't the one doing acid.
You didn't do acid. Oh, you
well,
were watching people do acid.
So Jed
uh-huh.
Babbitt that you're speaking of.
Great name, by the way.
He was 17.
Oh, okay.
His older brother and I, John, had gone to see Smashing Pumpkins.
Okay. This story's a little different. Okay.
We went to see Smashing Pumpkins at Metro.
Uh-huh.
And I mean,
ooh,
maybe
that's a cool show. Wow.
I was going to ask if you'd seen Smashing Pumpkins back in the day. What year was that?
That would have been early 90s. So yeah, we definitely saw them like when they were still like pushing Gish. Like, you could see him at Metro for $7 and just wait in line, and it wasn't even sold out.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yes, we used to see him a lot. Saw him play at Tower Records, like, doing an acoustic thing for when they released the set. What's it called? Siamese Daydream, the second album?
Siamese Dream, yeah.
Siamese Dream.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy.
We went home. We went back to John and Jed's house, well, their mom's house, and Jed was there with a young lady.
Is it possible that you were on acid and you believed that you were at a Smashing Pumpkins concert and that you had never left the house?
Anything's possible.
So you've never done acid?
Oh no, I'm not saying that at all. Oh. Just not that day. That
particular evening.
I was kind of, the funny thing was when you asked me to do this, I was kind of, I was hesitant at first.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not some rock guy. But I was just kind of thinking of some funny stories that have happened along the years. And so there's too many that happened around acid.
Oh, man, I didn't know this about you, Scotty. I didn't know you had an acid run.
It wasn't like a run. It was just, you know, it popped up every now and then.
I mean, more than a few times, I'd consider it a run. Did you ever like, see, I've still yet to try it, Scotty. Like after all these years, I was scared away from it early on for, I think, very valid reasons. But now I'm like starting to get to that point where I'm like, you know what? Like, let's open these doors. I'm ready. You know, like I want to see what's back here.
I mean, they're doing all the tests on it now that, like, you know, it's supposed to help you with all kinds of things.
Yeah. Did you ever find that it like took you somewhere you actually like really needed to go?
No.
No.
it just got us in trouble. And I mean, I can't imagine doing it. It's been decades.
Yeah.
At this point since I've done that, but I can't even imagine doing it now.
Have you ever been arrested?
No.
Oh, all that time.
I've never been arrested. I've been handcuffed.
Okay.
By the police, but I've never been arrested.
I like that you had to specify by the police.
I've been handcuffed.
Yeah. I know where your mind is wandering.
I've been handcuffed by a number of people, police being one of them. Listen, Scotty,
they weren't on duty.
You have you've always had a terrific body. I've always wondered, with that body, with that hair, what was going on at night when I fell asleep? I always thought you could have been getting into some sexual Fight Club type of stuff. Just saying.
What's your secret, Scotty? Because you are, if I think of like
just all the
older
acid.
People, stop doing acid or do it.
Just do loads.
Do loads of acid and I could look like you. I would be drinking bottles of it.
Yeah. You got to tell us, Scotty, like you look great. You've always looked great. What's the trick? What's the physical trick? What are you doing?
It's just mom and dad. I got lucky.
Pure genetics.
Pure genetics.
So there's nothing we can do at all for me and Benny,
Ian
who are like
I,
big boys.
650 pounds of slovenly mess over there.
Oh my gosh.
We've got no chance.
Ian, it was genetics the whole time.
You're beautiful humans.
People are telling us it was like nutrition.
I know.
So me and you were feeling guilty about our snack bags and shit. And it was just our parents.
No, you got a snack.
Should have had different parents. Could have been beautiful like Scotty.
Speaking of tours and snack bags, I guess people don't know what that is. Ian Perkins famously, at any gas station or rest area, US, Europe, he's usually feeling gregarious. And we'll come back into the van with something he calls a snack bag. It's filled with like, I don't even know where you get the money from. 20 to 30 euros or dollars worth of treats.
And goldfish.
And then
I was selling acid to Scotty.
And you can't help it. Like, you know, Scotty, how many times did you get roped into a snack bag? Where, like, come on, come on, come on. You have to eat.
All the time.
Yeah. Terrible for me. But speaking of touring, one of the things I always noticed about you, Scotty, was I really love the book Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And well, what I understand of it anyway, which is probably like a third of it. But there's one thing that always stands out in that book. There's like a principle that divides people. And they use the example of a dripping faucet. And that there are some people who cannot rest and cannot be okay with the things going on until they fix this faucet, right? Until, like, they can't rest until. And then there's another type of person who will just get accustomed to the leak and move on with their life. And this is a variation between two people. I've noticed something similar in touring with what people do on the first day of their bunk dictates kind of like the person they are, like as a whole, you know, it's like a giant reflection. And Scotty, you'll walk in to a bus first day, string up some lights, put a fan in, get like a little workstation set up, a little, you know, like it's just very clean, very organized and put together. Even think you'd sometimes get your own sheets and pillows. And then there are others who like, you know, toss a backpack in there and just basically wallow in their own filth for like a month.
Me. That's me.
Nah, you know, I was thinking about it. I think, Ian, you and I both are a little bit in the middle, I would say. Because even though you spend a lot of time in there, an unusual amount of time in there, it never stunk, you know? It never was stinky.
No.
You never
didn't
had,
go
like,
over to that.
Yeah, like across the way from you, you know, there was shit pouring out of it. And it just like a general musk, you know, that like, you're like, what is even happening in there? So... What is it about like you as a person like that you need to set up this station and get comfortable and need that kind of order to touring in order to be happy? Like, is that something that you found you need when you hit the road?
Yeah, it's always been like that though, you know, and I think maybe it stems back to all the time and months and months and months spent in, you know, a van where you kind of deck the van out to be comfortable, you know, and to be a home away from home. And when we started touring in buses, and we used to have fun, like on the trio bus, we said, you were on when we had the Halloween decorations that one year.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you'd make that late night stop somewhere and you'd go in and you usually had a few cocktails in you and you'd spend a bunch of money at Walmart on stupid crap to decorate your bunk, and okay. It just stuck. I love doing it. I love doing it.
And do you think that like my theory after all the touring you've done and stuff, do you think my theory is somewhat true that the way someone sets it up can kind of be like a marker of their personality on a bigger level?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So judge Ian and I,
you guys are both clean.
We're not so bad, right?
Yeah.
I think you could be clean though and not be that guy. I wouldn't say I have a great example of Scotty with me and little Alex got on the bus first day and we're sitting there late at night, no one's up, and we're in the front lounge and all these bottles are banging into each other and me and him are laughing and we're literally having a conversation talking about how there's two different people, the people that will get up and sort something out and the people that would just learn to deal with whatever the problem is.
Right, yeah.
And we were laughing every time these bottles were smashing together. We're just laughing every time and not moving. And Scotty walks in literally 10 seconds after he's walking. He's like, how the fuck are you sitting here listening to this? Yeah. And reorganized all the bottles instantly, which was hilarious to us. But that's the kind of person Scotty is. Yeah. And the difference between someone like myself, where I can literally learn to live with anything, noise, whatever it is, I'll just deal with it.
It's true.
And I feel like you're the kind of people, I would put you in there, Benny, that you're just like, I cannot live with this.
Oh, yeah.
I have to make this right.
Yeah.
Yeah, Benny, you're a super organized guy.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, there's no chance I'd let those bottles clang around. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it'd drive me fucking crazy.
They were clanging and we were laughing.
It's fucking funny, man. I love that shit. But Ian, like, it's so funny because I always remember with you as far as being like an incredibly adaptable. I think I envied you both, you know, because like in a way I always wished, I'm like, fuck, like I wish I was as organized as Scotty. Like, look at his bunk. That must be great to just live in there for a month. But there's no way I'm buying a mini fan, you know, like I'm just not doing it. But then you, Ian, I always remember airplanes with you. And you were always like, I almost like didn't believe you at first when you were like, yeah, I don't give a fuck. And I'm like, how does this guy who's like nearly 6'5", you know what I mean? Like doesn't drink, is not going to get on this plane and get hammered or anything. How is he actually okay with a middle seat going to Australia or something? Like this isn't possible that he's okay. He's faking it.
And then like no choice.
Yeah, and then after like, you know, months and months of knowing you, I'm like, wow, he really doesn't care. How?
You can't, Kat. You can't, Kat.
How do you let it go, Ian? How do you let that go?
You're like a magical creature that way, though.
Yeah.
No, but you really drive yourself crazy, because I'm not that kind of guy like Scotty, where he'll reorganize the whole plane. This, you have these drinks, you can do this, you sit there, you two shouldn't sit next to each other. I'm just like, this is my seat. I gotta be on this for 22 hours. Let's just roll with it and have a laugh.
I mean, I envy you.
It's some M&Ms.
Yeah, but that's why you got to have the snack bag. If I'm hungry, then it's a whole nother. No, I can't do it.
Wait, Scotty, we missed something. We did this mystery friend segment with the acid story, and you never guessed friend. So who do you think told me this incorrect story about doing acid at Jed Babbitt's house?
John Babbitt?
No. How the fuck would I get in touch with John Babbitt, Scotty?
No, I have no idea. Wait. Danny Andriano.
Yes.
All right.
Oh my God. Now I'm reading it back and I realize I fucked it up.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. This is it in quotes. He said, once when I was like 17 or so, I was doing acid at a friend named Jed Babbitt's house.
That's right. Danny was there.
So Danny was doing acid at Jed Babbitt's house and told me this story. Oh, okay. This is my fault altogether.
Jeez.
I'm sorry. Did I say that right?
That's funny that story came up.
So, Scotty, now you told me a story earlier today that kind of fascinated me and leads me into, you know, what you're doing these days. Can you tell me a little about the amphitheater you work at and the what happened post 9/11 and how it came to be? Because that was pretty fascinating.
And so I'm a production manager for a venue in Chicago, and it's on a little plot of land called Northerly Island, which at one point was Migs Field, which was a tiny privately run airport on the south side of Chicago, like literally just outside the city limits. It's right across from Soldier Field.
Okay.
So still city limits, just out of the downtown, you know, skyscraper area. So after 9/11 happened, every mayor in the country was so paranoid about their city being attacked.
Right.
That this little runway seemed like a target. So in the cover of night, Mayor Daley, who was the mayor at the time, had some guys go out there with large machinery and just carve giant X's into the runway. So it was wasn't usable anymore.
So unlandable.
Unlandable. So now it's been turned into a park. It's a city park. It's owned by the city. But every summer now we build a stage out there, and it's a Stageco stage, and it's a big steel structure, and it goes up every year, and we put up grandstands and all that every year, and it's a beautiful spot because on one side, on the east side of the venue, so if you're on stage looking to your left, it's 13th Street Beach and Lake Michigan, and then on the stage right side is Soldier Field, and there's marina in between Soldier Field and the island. And then behind the stage, kind of like the backdrop of the stage, is the skyline. So it's a beautiful spot.
Hmm. What was it like for you making that transfer to these, because you work all over the Midwest in these different places. You know, when you're going from the Fireside Bowl and the punk scene and Chicago shows, and then within, you know, the same lifetime, you're producing like stadium events and stuff. Like as far as the music is concerned and like the consumer's like, you know, connection to the music, what do you think at this point it takes for one of these like big amphitheater stadium shows to actually like connect with people the same way like a club show could do? Or is it even possible?
I think the people are looking for for something different, a different kind of connection. I think when you're at like a stadium event like that, I mean, no one these days watches the actual stage. Everybody's looking at the massive video walls, or right. they're staring at their phone because they're videotaping it so they can
right.
post it somewhere. But I think, you know, that punk rock energy that'll never, it can't happen in that environment. Like the bands don't put it off.
Right. Right.
You know what I mean? And the,
have you ever seen Coldplay?
Yeah.
There you go. They pull it off.
They do a pretty good job of it.
So out of all the bands you've seen through these years, like, who do you think did the best job of creating a really, really great, like, large scale show? And like, what were kind of some of the tricks that maybe made it happen like that?
U2 is definitely the best at it.
Oh, really?
You know, at the stadium shows, I think, in my personal opinion.
What makes them the best at it?
They just always have something just beyond creative as far as like a stage design. And I mean, they're all just so good at what they do. And the music's, I've always loved U2, like since I was in high school. Like, yeah. I've always been a U2 fan.
I would say they wrote the book, wouldn't you? On like that kind of show.
Yeah.
What about Rush?
Modern day.
Rush?
No, like modern day, like Rush, a modern day, like stadium show.
Yeah.
If you're looking at who set the bar, U2, or every record.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, and then the way they present it is just, it's, I mean, no one else can afford it to do it.
Right.
You know, yeah, I mean, yeah. It's so expensive, like what they do. But then you got, you know, Pearl Jam's a great example, because I did not like Pearl Jam at all when I was younger, when they right. came out.
Yeah.
I just thought that was crap. but now I love them. Like, I think they're great. I like all their albums, even the stuff that I thought was crap when I was younger.
Okay.
But that touches on like another, and I actually heard you, I was listening to the Maddie, and Dave Hawes, show you did.
Right.
And that kind of touches on that subject of when you're punk rock, you know, you can't like certain things.
Yeah. Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, Pearl Jam is off limits.
Yeah, I think so. But
yeah.
Now,
I had like a 10-year break on Pearl Jam from like 14 to 24. And then I was like, okay, I can like them again.
And they're great. And they deliver that kind of energy,
right.
You know, in the same way. But
what's the, like, what's the largest production that ever showed up? Like
YouTube.
What is it? Like, how many trucks, like how many people? Is it just like a village?
Yeah. So the U2 show, when they did the, I don't know if you've ever seen pictures, it was the 360 tour. They did it.
Right.
They did two world tours of it. They split them up because, like there was a back injury or something like that. But they had that claw, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And that thing was like, I mean, that show, I want to say it was over, I think it was over 50 steel trucks.
Holy shit.
And then like 30 or 40 production trucks.
Oh my God.
It was just mental, you know, it's just so big. And then the way it was plopped in the middle of a field. And they had to buy every stadium they went to, they had to buy all that grass because it was never coming back.
Get the fuck out of here.
The weight of that thing. So,
whoa.
Yeah. I mean, that show is just incredible.
What's that cost you? Like buying. what's it like? I show up to Soldier Field. I'm like, I want to fuck up the grass tonight. How much is it going to cost me? Like,
I mean, it would have to be $500,000, $750,000, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, because it's probably the highest quality grass. Like, you're going
to take Soldier Field.
We'll take two.
Yeah, you buy the beautiful sod farm. That's insane how many trucks it is and stuff. That's wild. And how many people do you think are part of the, well, you probably know, like how many people are part of that production?
Hundreds.
Yeah. It's like so this really is like, you know, now that you're on this side of the business and we were dealing with, you know, COVID, I even talked to a friend the other day where I was realizing, you know, I think at first, when we first started the pandemic, I was sort of in the mindset that people who are saying that art and music and things like this are vital, you know, vital things to society. I think I brushed it off a little because in a way I was like, this is not life or death. Like it doesn't matter. But then like as the time went on and I could see really like what I was missing, what it provides for other people. Like, do you think that the entire industry, not just from a creative and consumer end, but also from like the business end, like a band like U2 literally employing just like hundreds of people and all these production companies and people like you who rely on them to come there. Like, do you think these businesses should have been considered more vital from the start and more subsidized as we went through this?
Absolutely. I think the US probably did the least in terms of like, you know, who we consider, you know, our friends and where these other bands are coming from. Like UK and European countries set up much larger grants for people that were, you know, in the arts and trying to, you know, keep them on some sort of livable wage. And, you know, it's, our unemployment has gone up in this country, but it's still not the same, but it took the bands themselves doing it. Mm. You know, where you'll see a lot of bands now that were supposed to tour last year, where they, you know, they came out with a special hoodie, you know, right, that you can buy, and all the money for the hoodie goes towards their crew. Even like, you know, like friends of ours, like Rise Against, sure, you know, doing, yeah, stuff like that. But, and then, you know, I've seen other bands like Foo Fighters, they're such a poster driven band, mm, you know, like everybody collects Foo Fighters posters. And so they had a different poster made for their whole tour that was canceled. But instead of those posters just getting scrapped, they auctioned them off. And like, I have a friend that actually made the one for Minneapolis, and he put it up on his site and everything. And so the Foo Fighters were advertising it. So it just, instead of the government helping or making people more aware of it, it just took the artists to do it, you know?
Yeah. And
or things like Crew Nation and things,
right,
like that.
Right. Yeah, it's so crazy, man. That just, it's not considered, yeah, I don't know. It's even something as simple as like just getting together for band practice, human interaction, you know, it's just like it pays so much dividends. It's really wild, man.
It's been
so
weird.
What do you think, you know, in your expertise now, like, what do you think this is all going to look like moving forward? Like, are we looking at just exactly what it was a couple years ago, or what do you think are going to be like the permanent changes to these industries?
It's hard to say, you know, like, I guess a lot will depend on what happens with, you know, the idea of like a vaccine passport or, you know, if people, you know, people still got to twist people's arm to get a vaccine.
Right.
But, I think this summer will be, we'll start to see some stuff. I think the bummer is it's going to be the independent clubs and the indoor spots, you know, like a little, you know, Metro, where you only got, you know, 1,100 people in there,
right,
but they're packed, you know, shoulder to shoulder. There's no way to socially distance that, where, you know, in an arena or something, you can scatter people.
Yeah. Right.
So I think I'm optimistic. I think the summer will be, you know, we'll see some outside stuff. I think, you know, hopefully, once fall rolls around, that things are a bit more controlled and you start to see some clubs open up again. And it's going to be state by state, I guess, but it's funny because, you know, like certain states were pushing for everything to open and to have shows, but we all know you can't do a tour in Texas. You can play a lot of shows in Texas, right, but you can't do a tour in Texas.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know,
and most punk bands aren't going to make much money down there anyway. The old Texas punk rock market, all four of you.
When New York goes, what, July 1st, 100% open?
Yeah, they're going for it. We'll see. Yeah, I mean,
and Chicago's got the same politics as New York, pretty much. So right. I think it won't be long. I think we're doing July 4th.
Yeah, stadiums are going for it, half capacity soon. You know, we'll hope it works out, right? So before I let you guys go, the two of you, I need to do something combined, okay? And I know you might have to fight a little about it.
I won't fight Scotty. He's too muscly.
It's true. He probably knows some weird like MMA moves, you know? You just lock up your leg and you'd be fucked.
He'd probably just tickle you. He'd tickle you into submission because he's so nice.
You're the tickle monster.
No, but he's got that beautiful body. I don't know. I just can't take that on.
All right. Before this gets too overtly sexual, I'd like the two of you to please rank the three best Fugazi albums in history.
Oh, boy.
Oh, can I say one thing before?
Yes.
That one of my favorite memories all time when I think of Scotty is when we first were working together, we would have Fugazi Fridays.
Fugazi Fridays.
Every Friday, we would only listen to Fugazi every Friday.
I don't remember
and
that.
It's one of my, when I think Scotty, if someone's like, what kind of a guy is Scotty? I'm like, he's a beautiful man, beautiful body, Fugazi Friday.
I think Ian just wrote your epitaph, Scotty. Beautiful man, beautiful body, Fugazi Fridays.
I've probably listened to Fugazi more with Scotty than any other person. We've listened to every record, every second of every record together, 100%.
And you are the two perfect people to answer this question. So I not only want the top three, I'd like them in order, please.
Oh, God, don't make us pick.
I know my top one for sure is In on the Kill Taker.
Oh, no.
Is that even in your top three?
I like the later records more than like, End Hits would be my favorite, I think. And I know it's not like many people's, but
I like, I would say,
I just think it sounds better, but I don't know. Don't make us pick. It's like saying pick your favorite kids, I think.
Yeah.
If I had kids,
which is super easy.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, some kids are assholes, you know, and some kids aren't. Some Fugazi records are better than other ones. What is this?
Ooh.
Come on, give me a top three.
Oh, God. Well, no, I can't. We listen to every second of every record. I can tell you, I can speak for both of us that we love every second. There's not many bands that you could say that about.
Man.
You know what I mean?
I really needed of you guys to be more controversial, you know?
I'm definitely sticking with In on the Kill Taker for number one. I would probably say Steady a Diet, number two.
Ooh, yeah.
And I like End Hits too, but I really like Red Medicine.
Oh yeah.
Red Medicine's good. You can't pick three then.
So those would be right smack dab in the middle of those three.
Well, what if I pick one, End Hits, you pick one, and then we'll pick one together, Red Medicine.
There you go.
All top right. three.
So we got End Hits, In on the Kill Taker, Red Medicine.
Oh, that's such a tough.
I love that you guys are leaving out 13 songs, and I love that you're leaving out The Argument, because I'd assume those are probably the two most picked albums.
I'll tell you,
you think The Argument's the most picked?
I think it's
I hated it when I first heard it. I'll tell you right now, I was like, what the fuck is this? And then I was supposed to see them and it got cancelled in London, and by the time the show was rescheduled, I was like, this is the best record I've ever heard in my life. I completely didn't get it at the beginning. Yeah. And I feel like there's a lot of records like that where you like, well, that goes into a whole nother thing of instant music that's like all out now. Do you know what I mean? I just don't think there's much music coming out like that now where you're like, I'm going to have to sit on this for a couple of months and like hear it at the right time. But yeah, that record, oh.
Because that's all of them, though. That's the live energy you want to capture.
Mm. Yeah.
That's true.
That's untouchable.
Did you ever see Fugazi in Chicago back in the day?
Sure.
Oh, you just say sure like it's like no big deal.
Scoop of chocolate, scoop of vanilla. No, don't waste my time.
We had, there's one show, it was at an old, it was an abandoned roller rink called Rainbow Roller Rink. And they played there. And here, this will just be another good guy story. So they played there. We were all broke. And a handful of us volunteered to work the show, right? So we were just kind of just doing whatever you need to do. It wasn't like security or anything like that. But the guy that put on the show, have you guys ever seen that? There's a split 7-inch and it's Jawbox and Tar. And they each have a song called Static, but on the 7-inch, they cover each other's song, Static.
Hmm. Okay.
So there's a man on that cover, his name's Bernie. And he's the one that put on the show in Chicago. And I guess he was just a personal friend. And so we all volunteered to work the show so we could go see it. It was Fugazi and the Makeup. Ooh. And this is a roller rink. And
could you roller skate at the show?
Oh, no. I thought you were asking if I could roller skate.
I'm shocked that you don't know how to roller skate.
Yeah, we know you can roller skate. You can do everything. But just at the show, that would have been cool.
That would have been cool. But months later, I was at Metro, and we were playing a late show. And Bernie was there for the early show. And I didn't know this man at all. Like, Brian knew him. That's how I got hooked up to work the Fugazi show. So he sees me, and he recognizes me, and he reaches into his pocket. And I can't remember how much he pulled out. It was like 20, 30 bucks. And he hands it to me. And he said, the guys from the band wanted me to find everybody that volunteered for that Fugazi show somehow and just give them some cash. So I was like,
wow.
All right.
So you got paid to go to the show.
Yeah.
Oh, how was the show, though? Amazing.
They were great.
The last thing I like to ask people right now is, like, you know, some people are struggling day to day. What's the kind of stuff that you're using on a day-to-day basis to kind of stay sane? And are there any music or books or podcasts that you could recommend to the people?
I take a lot of walks.
Nice.
Right now. So we moved, when we moved back from Manchester, we bought a house, but we're way out in the sticks now. We're like way out of the city.
Okay.
So there's lots of walking paths. So yeah, I take long walks a lot to stay sane. Podcasts, I'm into, like, I listen to a lot of like conspiracy theory podcasts because I'm fascinated by how people get sucked into things. Like, when I read books, I don't really read fiction very often. Mm-hmm. I like nonfiction, and I like it about people that are just kind of, that get into weird shit.
That's cool.
Like, I love people that for some reason just like, man, and during the pandemic, this whole, the QAnon thing,
right,
has been so magnificent to read about and to listen to podcasts about, because that shit is just bananas.
Yeah, no, it's insane.
It's so bananas. But I don't know. We kind of have a nice routine. Beck's still working, so spend some time with the dog and go for walks, and we watch something after dinner and just try and keep a head up straight.
Love it. All right, yeah. Scotty. Well, thanks for doing this with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
I, man,
I appreciate that.
I'm still here.
Yo, I love you. Thanks for doing this.
Love, yeah, I love you guys, man.
I miss you guys.
Love.
That was fun.
Brad. Man, did you ever see like Smashing Pumpkins in a weird little venue?
No, I did not ever see Smashing Pumpkins. But, you know, I was wondering, like, if I ever... when was Scotty there, like, at Fireside working there, do you think?
I think, like mid to late 90s.
Because, like, I was going to bring it up, but there was enough people talking, and I couldn't remember. But, yeah, I mean, I played Fireside 96, 97, 98.
Ah.
3 years running. 96 is with the Souls.
Uh-huh.
97 was with, we were on tour with 22 Jacks.
Oh, nice.
And actually, I think Lunatics played that night, too.
Cool.
And then 98, I don't remember. I think it was just an off night blown through.
What a great venue. I mean, it's like one of the...
So cool. So yeah, cool.
Like it's hard to describe. I mean, for people from New Jersey, we got a little bit of a taste with the original Asbury Lanes. You know, not the one we have now, which, you know, the locals hate. I don't mind. But like places like that just, I mean, fuck. Not only do they not exist anymore, but as per this conversation we just had, like, fuck, how hard is it going to be for places like this
to
survive now, or the ones that did survive? It's really like something this conversation did to me. And like, you know, going into it is like, I don't know. I don't know if I've been naive to it this whole time or something, but I really am like stunned at this point at the lack of commitment to the arts. It just feels so crazy now that I see how much money went to so many different places, the people who needed it, and just these like real serious gear functions of how people survive and how people find joy and how people make their livings and how just that wasn't considered vital. It's just such a, it's another stain among many stains of this whole thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But, it made me laugh because it always makes me think of Van Halen and their brown M&M story, you know, how like they just like snuck that into the middle of the contract to make sure that people were reading their technical specs. And when I hear about U2 showing up with like, fuck, like 100 trucks, you know, like how many buses, like that is like an industry. It's like its own, it's its own industry, you know? Like,
oh yeah. No, it's a small town there.
U2
Corp. Definitely a small industry. Yeah, for real. I'm sure. I hung out with U2's like engineer, like Bono's like vocal engineer one time, and he told me this hilarious story about I guess the Edge has this huge pedal board.
I'd imagine, yeah.
Yeah, as you would think. But and I don't even know how this, as a technical guy, I don't know how this is possible, but there's an exact replica of it just off stage, and his guitar tech stands over it for the whole show so that if Edge cannot, you know, because he changes stuff so often.
Yeah.
If he can't make it back to the pedal board, like the tech will change, make the change for him. But I guess he's like always fucking with him. Like he'll lift his foot like over a pedal, like right before the part, and then like not stomp it just to like fuck with his tech. It's just like knowing like how massive their show is and how kind of important. And I mean, I like you too, but like, let's face it, a lot of the Edge's sound comes from those fucking pedals.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And like, it's just hilarious that that's what he would choose to fuck around with. Like the thing that might actually really make a difference to his sound, but.
Yeah. I mean, so are you one of those, like, from a drummer's perspective, right? I always watch that one, I forget the documentary, but the one that was like Jimmy Page, Jack White, and the Edge.
That's
where,
a
like,
good
Jimmy Page and Jack White are basically
just destroying
playing
the
him
Edge.
Out the whole fucking time. Just like, yeah, you're not a guitar player. Like, we are. Enjoy your toys.
He couldn't really keep up with them, dude. Like,
I mean, that's where, but do we consider, like, I've seen people do amazing stuff with that technology, and to say that part of it is not a skill.
No, it's a very different,
the manipulation of these things.
Yeah. It kind of wasn't fair. I even realized that when I was watching
it. Fair. Yeah. Like, and then, you know, from a drummer's perspective, when I'm like writing songs from a rhythmic perspective, 9 times out of 10, I'd rather you motherfuckers play a beautiful note, let it hang over 4 bars with some fucking pedals on it instead of noodling all over this beautiful fucking part.
Yeah.
You know?
So it's funny you bring that up because as I was watching that, I remember thinking like, yeah, this is not really fair. This would be like me trying to sit in with a couple of like, you know, like classical guitar players or like jazz players play these chords that I don't even know what they are. Like, I wouldn't even know how to play them. And that's like, kind of what was happening there.
Exactly.
Like, these are two blues based dudes. Like,
right.
And like, he just, yeah, he was lost, but it's like, it was good though. It's a good, I enjoyed that little, what was that, like Netflix or something?
Yeah. I forget what it was. It was really interesting though. Yeah. It's like me sitting in a room with like Terry Bozzio and being like, hey, you like, dig like the new ISIS record, you know, you want to get stoned and just play super slow with me, Terry? Yeah. Just, I don't know. Different vibe. And, yeah, yeah. And, I mean, as a guitar player, like who else was doing like who was doing in mainstream what the Edge was doing? Like Robert Smith, like the Cure kind of stuff? Like was there any precedent for it before?
No, he kinda really did invent he was not even a guitar. I mean, his thing is more like almost, I hate to use this word, it's so overused, but it's more like sound design almost than guitar playing. And yeah, I read a thing once where was it Lenoir or whoever the producer they used to use a lot was talking about their whole thing was to make a vibe, to make like they would just jam on things for hours until everybody was playing something that just created like this incredible ambience. And then they would write a song around it. Mm. And it really makes sense because it's not, their stuff doesn't sound, whether you love them or hate them, like there's not really anybody that gets that sound or that like kind of presence, that vibe as U2 does.
Totally. And understood that thing about, you know, about the show. You know, that's like, you know, I've had that conversation with a lot of people over the years. Like once you get to a certain size, once you start charging certain amount for tickets, what is your responsibility as far as putting on a show is concerned? You know, like, like seriously, like if you're getting to like a stadium level and you're charging $50 for your show and just four bozos get up there in their jeans and rip of the hour and a half of songs. Like, I know it's cool and it'll sound good, but are they doing like the whole thing a disservice? Like once you get to that point, do you have a responsibility to like give a little bit of a show?
Oh yeah. They try to bring the show. And, I saw them play the Zoo TV tour with Primus opening. And you know, this was back when I was full on like unapologetic punk rocker.
Right.
So I thought that the stage overwhelmed them. You know, it was really, they had a lot going on that stage. Mm. But in the middle of the show, they came out and did and this was one of the first times I had seen this. Everybody does it now, but where they came out and did kind of an acoustic set in the middle of the audience.
Right.
And that was mesmerizing. Yeah. I think Lou Reed came and like did a song with them. And that was when I was like, oh my God, like that was really engaging. And I talked to somebody else who was like a fan of U2 who said that tour kind of like that it was a little overblown and they realized afterwards that maybe the stage had overwhelmed them. And I think they figured out after that how to bring it closer to the audience.
I think it's rad. Maybe it's because my first big show ever was seeing Rush. You know,
yeah.
So I'm into the lights. I'm into the.
Oh, you know, yeah. The I think you should bring quality. A show. You should bring a show for sure, man.
Yeah. For something like that, you know, and even Gaslight ran into it at a certain point. Like we want it to be that band. Like, all right, you're coming. You're coming for these fucking songs. Let's, you know, instead of a stage show, we're going to play 28 songs straight with no encore. You know, like that's how we're going to do it instead. But we even got to a point, you're watching videos of it and you're like, I don't know, it looks fucking empty up there. You know, like there's only five of us and this stage is huge. Like we kind of look like assholes, you know, like
should have got a gospel choir, dude.
I know something. I got to play with an orchestra once on the, on the late night show. That was kind of cool. I was terrified. I was like, wow, these people are actually really counting. and I'm just bobbing my head in time. Uh-oh. I'm like, they're going to figure me out. But anyway, I know we quickly mentioned it in the interview. Scotty is a fantastic photographer. posts a lot of cool shit about, you know, the work he's doing now and some of the old tours. He's got a million great Gaslight photos. Actually, most of the ones that appear, most of the ones that appear in the Gaslight Instagram these days are Scotty's. So everyone should check out his Instagram. He's just at Scotty Anna. And then, of course, check out the Perkins, Perkins 28. He's on there too. One of the finest people I know. A couple of the finest people I know.
Yeah, you can tell. I think I could tell that you are fond of those guys.
I am. I just want to keep talking to them. So thanks for coming on to the program and listening. And
thanks for listening. Leave us a review on the Apple Podcasts. Used to be called iTunes. You can leave a Benny review or whatever you're comfortable with.
What's a Benny review, Brad?
Oh, when I listen to Going Off Track, I go.
Wow. And we're out.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.